Welcome to Take the Red Pill,
where we explore the realities within our reality.
We are your hosts, David Deere
and Donald Dalton.
This episode, we are going to revisit a couple of topics that we've visited before. We did an episode on love, and we did an episode on fear. So now we're actually going to counterbalance the two, and we're going to be talking about love and fear, or love versus fear, however you want to look at that. Donald, why don't you go ahead and roll us off, see what I'm curious what you have to say about this.
Yeah, I think with both the love episode and the fear episode, we got to the end, as we do with many of our recordings, and we were just like, there's so much more we could do here. We can contrast so much more. And I think this topic presented itself in a way of saying, hey, you know how you all said you wanted to revisit these episodes, these topics? Well, here you go. And I know in those episodes we did do a little bit of contrasting, but I find the emotions of just love and fear are so, they're so primal, they're so integral, they're like ones and zeros to computer language. They're like the basic building blocks of emotion. Because from I see everything, every emotion is a subtext of love or fear. If you're upset, if you're angry at something, that's more of a fear side. If you're feeling elated and excited, that's more of a love side. And so the interesting point is, I've always wondered what happens right in the absolute middle of love and fear. Is there anything?
In the middle of it?
Yeah. If you drew a line and one side you had fear and on the other side you had love, let's start on complete fear side of the line. And as you move closer to love, the emotions become less and less fear-based and more love-based. Anger turns to mild annoyance or whatnot. And then once you shift over that line, they're more love-based instead of fear-based. Well, what happens right smack dab in the middle of that?
As has been stated, I think Sean, remember when we had Sean and Debbie on?
Oh, yeah.
With the Twin Flames conversation?
Mm-hmm.
We were talking about ascension in that. But I think if we go with what he said, and if we go with what we've said in other episodes before, is that there are only two emotions, which is love and or fear, as it were. If that's the case, then there really can't be a middle, can there?
I see what you're saying, but is it possible where there absolutely cannot be any place in between, even for a moment, where you're either absolutely in the love side or absolutely on the love fear, or the fear side? You know, kind of like in the United States crossing over a state border, you know, that one imaginary line that's right there, and you see the sign on the side of the road, and you can actually have one foot in one state and the other foot in the other state. But right down the middle, no matter how infinitesimal you go, there's still that dividing line. And you're saying that emotionally, there's absolutely no way that's there. It's either one side or the other?
I would venture to say this. I would say that there is not one side or the other. I would say that it's all one of the same.
Okay, so love and fear is the same?
Yes, that's what I would say.
Oh. Love.
You're going, what do I do with this here? What is this
okay.
guy saying to me?
Okay, so love is not the absence of fear. It's the other side of fear.
And no, fear... I think fear is a... See, we love to polarize so much as human beings, you know, and thanks to whatever dogma that we've kind of grown up with in our belief system, we've always wanted to polarize something. There's always good and evil. There's always light and dark. And there's all these things, but they stem from the same thing. You see, and I think love and fear is one of those things. We say that the opposite of love is fear, or that the absence of love is fear, or the absence of fear is love, and all this other stuff. And I'm saying to you that love and fear is, when people say that there are only these two things that we respond based on, I say we only respond based on love, period. And I'd say that fear is just a byproduct of love.
How is it a byproduct?
Well, okay, give me a scenario of a fear-based. If we're talking about love and fear, Give me a scenario of each. What would a person do out of love, and what would a person do out of fear that would make them opposites?
Okay.
And then I'll marry him up.
I'm going to be very general and very, probably almost boring, but not going for a job interview or applying for a job because you don't feel that, like, you'd get it. And then out of one example out of love would be, you know, a mother making dinner for her family.
So let's go with the fear scenario. We say that the idea here is that all the spiritual circles and all the enlightenment hugs, all this other stuff, they like to say that what stops us from fulfilling, from being our true to ourselves and our true selves is our fears, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the idea with the job interview, this person is afraid of rejection for the job interview. So they're afraid of rejection because rejection, all that does is it confirms that they don't have any self-worth, correct?
I see where you're going. Okay.
You see where I'm going? Okay.
Yeah.
Tell me where you think I'm going, because I'm curious as to what you're getting from
this. I opened my mouth. I should have kept this.
What is it? En la boca cerrada no entran moscas.
Yes, I want to retract my previous statement. And like, I think I know where you're going, but I can't formulate the words, and I'm going to... For time, I'm going to allow you to continue with your
description. No, you can't back out of this.
No. Okay. So, so what we're talking about is the feeling of rejection from not going for the job is a feeling of self-worth or lack of self-worth, which you would say is a byproduct of not feeling love for yourself.
But are they not feeling love for themselves? We might interpret it that way, but it's out of love for the self, because what they're doing is they're protecting themselves from pain.
Mm-hmm.
So it's love of the self. It's love of the ego. And then we can go in another direction when it comes to ego. And maybe that's where this conversation needs to go. Maybe it does need to go in that direction, because, you know, a lot of the spiritual circles and a lot of the Buddhists and all these people say that the ego sometimes is our greatest enemy, which I would not 100% agree with.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a scenario where he's protecting his or she. Did we say it was a male or female?
I was genderless.
Male. Let's go with male. We already went down that road. So he's protecting his pride.
Uh-huh.
He's protecting his feelings because he loves his pride, and he loves the part of himself that feels safe. So the fear is based on the love of feeling safe, and having that self-esteem compromised, it seems like a fear response, but it is a love response.
Hmm. Kind of like the strength of his love to not feel self-worth compromised is stronger than his desire to actually get the job. In other words, if I understand what you're saying, and I think I do, then his love of his comfort level of where he is right now is more important than risking changing that for another job opportunity.
Exactly. Okay. Yep.
And that is how both love and fear are the same thing. It's just one with any instance, with any situation. If I understand you correctly, you're saying that either love is the stronger emotion or either fear is the stronger emotion, and we act out of whichever one's strongest.
No, I would say love is a stronger emotion.
Oh, I thought I had it.
You did. You were close. You actually were really there. I know what you're saying, but what I'm saying is this. It's what I hear often is it's fear that stops us from living a fulfilled life, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And what it is it's not that we have fears. It's that whatever we're afraid of, whatever we're not doing, we'll just say that. We'll just simply say we don't do something out of fear.
Okay.
It's not that we're not doing something out of fear. It's we're not doing something out of the love of what we're doing, that if we did this other thing, it would prevent us from doing or being. So the love is more compelling. The love of the current situation. The fear is changing your situation, right?
Okay.
You have a fear. You say, well, if I do this, it's going to change the situation I'm in now. Rather, it's loving the situation you're in now that keeps you. I honestly think fears are just excuses. Fears are just, it's double talk in our mind. It's us saying, you know, I'm afraid of the rejection. It's not that. They're not afraid of rejection. What it really is that they love where they are more then they love the idea of changing where they are.
Yeah.
Because it's safe, it's familiar. They love that familiarity. They may wish they could do something different, but the wish is not compelling enough to change the love of the familiarity.
Yeah, to me, the way I see that in my head is just a stronger level of love and a weaker level of fear. And you said that that was incorrect, but it was close. Kind of like bar graphs, if you look at it. Like, we take this one situation, you know, where we put ourselves in, and you said it was a guy? Yeah, okay.
Yeah, why not? Yeah.
Fred McMulderberry.
Ooh, yeah. He's our punching bag. He's like Fred McPiñata, I think, for take the red pill.
Exactly. Okay, so let's say he has an opportunity to apply for a new job.
Mm-hmm.
And with that situation, with that opportunity, for me, I see two bar graphs, two bars. And one is love of where he is right now, and one is fear of, you know, things changing. And from our discussion, from what we've said, to me in my head, I see the bar graph for love of staying where he is and the comfort level of where he is higher, is stronger than the one for the fear. And you said that that was close but not quite correct. And I think I'm still missing that part where I'm incorrect, because it sounded like you said that and then you went back, and from what I heard, you were describing exactly what I was saying. And I was like, well, what part am I missing?
You're saying that, well, what I heard you say is the fear, you either have a love that's greater or a fear that's greater.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm telling you that if love and fear are really the same thing, then you can't really differentiate it. In fact, I think sometimes we do ourselves a disservice when we empower fear.
Oh, okay.
Because what we do is we don't really look at it. I'm just going to say love, you can tell where your love is by the energy you exert. And yes, so you could say people exert energy avoiding something, but they're not avoiding anything. What they're doing is they're staying in a place.
Hmm.
So I'm saying, where's the energy going? And that's where the love is. The love is where the energy is going.
So it's okay for Fred McMulderberry to not go for this opportunity because he's expressing more love for where he is instead of taking an opportunity that might work out better for him or not. Who knows?
Well, that kind of goes to our very last episode, the episode on life and death.
Uh-huh.
When we say, is it okay for him? That's his decision. That's his thing, you see.
Yeah. Well,
if he doesn't think it's okay for him, then we're talking about some ego stuff and some really weird, twisted stuff.
Well, see, the reason why I say that is because one of the things that, you know, we hear all the time is nothing lasts forever except change. Or the only thing that you can count on to ever happen is change. In other words, things are always changing. And how long can one person be in one place, regardless of how much they love that place and they feel comfortable in that place, before it starts to change and they need to find a different place to be?
So you're saying if they get forced out of it by the lack of entropy, a change?
From my experience and from what I've viewed and seen through people throughout my whole life, is you have a number of opportunities where you have the choice to make a change before the change happens to you, with not necessarily with your choice, if that makes sense. Kind of like I'll use me as an example, because years and years ago I actually was delivering I was a pizza delivery driver.
Mm-hmm.
When I started, I was working part-time, and I was making good money for working part-time, going to school, and all that kind of stuff. And then within 3 years, the gas prices started to really start to bump up, and I actually hit a level, and I told myself, if I ever hit a level where I am gas is this price for 6 months or more, or over it, then I am losing money on this job, and I'm going to move on and not do it anymore. Well, I apparently had forgotten that I'd said that, and gas prices had gotten up to that level for over 6 months, and then all of a sudden, there was just, it was like a moment of going on automatic, where I was just like, I was in the back, and I was washing dishes, and I was just like, I'm done. I'm just done. And I finished what was in the sink, and then I went to my manager. I'm like, I'm going to put in my 2 weeks right now. And it was like within 3 minutes, I had turned in my uniform and was driving home, and I felt so much more relief. It seemed like the choice there was, it was getting to the absolute point where I still had a choice to leave on my own or, you know, have something, maybe my car, I got in a wreck or something on the job and would no longer be able to be at that job anymore, because that actually happened with a previous delivery job that I had back in the 90s. So that's kind of, does that make sense?
Yeah, but what's the bullet point on this?
The bullet point is everything's going to change one way or another.
Right.
And the idea is to have the change come more on your terms, make the choices that allow the change to happen, as opposed to having the change happen without that. Kind of like having Fred McMuldenberry make the choice to apply for the job, as opposed to him getting laid off and having to apply for a job or else become homeless.
Well, there's a lot of homeless people out there, though. And I'm not saying that it's out of a fault of their own, but I think that, and, you know, to sound, forgive me, to sound conservative and dispassionate, it's not that the two are synonymous. I want to be careful to say that. but there is work that homeless people can do.
Mm-hmm.
There's where I say that because there are people who come into this country with no documentation, with no credentials, with nothing, without a roof on their heads, literally, and they're able to work. Like I said, I know that there are exceptions to that rule. I know that not everybody's in a situation where they can work, but there are people that are in a situation where they can work and they don't work. And the reason they don't is because they would prefer to their current circumstance. Because whatever it is seems more frightening. I don't think it's that it seems more frightening. It's that if the choice between what they're wanting to do, it's not the fear that compels them. It's the where they are that compels them. I believe that. It sounds really harsh to say that, but that's what I believe for pretty much across the board with some really weird exceptions on like life path levels and stuff.
Yeah, and that's what I'm talking about, because we had mentioned that the love of Fred McMuldenberry that he has for being where he is right now is stronger than his fear of actually getting the job or applying for the job.
Mm-hmm.
What I was saying for that is if his love for being where he is right now continues on and on and on, then sooner or later it's going to have to change in one way or another.
I see what you're saying.
I'm not saying this job opportunity he has to apply for.
Mm-hmm.
I'm saying that this is an opportunity that he can apply for because change is going to happen anyway. And, you know, should he delay the change happening, which is a choice, or should he be, you know, take the opportunity that happens because change is going to happen anyway? And the whole idea of the fear of not knowing where that change is going to happen if we don't take the choices that we are offered is, to me, much more frightening and scary than putting our choices out there, our ideas, are attempting to make things happen for our lives, and as opposed to life happening to us.
Well, maybe that's his choice. Maybe what his love is to have, and now we're going to start to get into the ego stuff, but maybe his love is to not have to make any decisions or choice. Perhaps let's carry this out. So he doesn't go to get his job. And what happens is all of a sudden he doesn't have enough money to cover his rent and he's facing eviction, right?
Mm-hmm.
He knows that he's going to get evicted, but he is petrified of being rejected for this job. And I know this is a really simple analogy. Life's a little more complicated than this. It's not the board game of life, Milton Bradley. Thank you. Yeah, that one's a weird one to me. The game of life was just... You played that, right?
Oh, yeah.
What reality was that game based on?
1950s reality? I don't know.
Yeah, because it was... Well, okay, I won't digress there, but I was thinking about it the other day. I saw the game of life somewhere, and I was like, Ooh, yeah, no. It doesn't really work that way. Maybe the love for him is letting life happen for him.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe his love is letting decisions be made for him, so he doesn't have to make those decisions. Granted, they may not be the decisions he wanted, the outcome he wanted, but at least he didn't have to make any decision. He did, but in his mind, he didn't. He likes the illusion, and I think this is where we go into the whole ego part. And I think fear, what fear is fear is the ego creating an illusion to make you feel like what it is you love is something that you don't really love and is outside of your control.
Kind of like pulling the wool over your eyes.
Yeah, I think that's what's going on. I think that that's what creates. Oh. I think fear is an illusion. Let's even go so far to say that.
Or I'm going to use rose tinted goggles, like or we can. There's so many analogies that just popped into my head. Or beer goggles, you know, kind of like you're at a bar. We're going to say Fred Mulderberry. He's at a bar. He's drinking. He's picking up some girl, but he has beer goggles on because he's been drinking all night, and she looks really attractive. But in the next morning, she doesn't look so attractive, and it's kind of like the without the rose-colored goggles, the ego, as it were, he would have seen what this woman was more like immediately, and probably not taking her home, as opposed to being like, she's amazing. I'm going to go home right now.
You know, I like your analogy, Donald. It's a very, very apt analogy.
Because being drunk makes the ego go away.
Well, it twists things.
Or it intensifies for some people.
Well, you know, it's one of those things where if he just wants to go home with someone, and the thing that stops him is how she looks, the inhibition part is once again removed with the alcohol. So really, he's not worried about the looks anymore. He's worried about getting straight to the objective, which is to take somebody home. So yeah, I think that the ego does the same thing. The ego is kind of when, if there's something we love and we don't think it's something that we're supposed to love because the ego gets in there, then what fear is the fear is the excuse creator so that we can go back to what it is we love.
Oh, kind of like in our example with Fred McMulderberry at the bar with his beer goggles on. If he wasn't drunk and he didn't have his beer goggles on, he'd look at somebody and be like, wow, she's really attractive. I find her really pretty. Oh, man, but she's so out of my league. You know, she would shoot me down the moment I opened my mouth to talk to her. You know, the whole excuse part being the ego part, whereas, you know, having the beer goggles on, it's more objective based, like, I'm man, you're woman, I want woman. You know, and I feel kind of silly using a bar analogy.
That works really well, the bar analogy, because what's happening here for, and I'm going to take it to the degree of rather there's this woman that he may not, well, we're saying he's straight, okay?
Okay.
So there's this woman that he sees that he doesn't find it attractive, so he doesn't really make a move.
Okay.
But then he drinks and he gets drunk, and then he decides the beer goggles come on, and she is attractive enough for his objective, you see.
Okay.
And I think that's what happens is the fear is like the sobriety part of us. The fear is saying, you know, the whole crux of the matter is you almost, I'm not a drinker and I don't subscribe to making really bad decisions when you're drunk. But there is kind of something really interesting about that whole analogy is because you almost have to respect the fact that the base level of just wanting to take somebody home wins. And all of the other window dressing is pushed aside.
Hmm.
It's to me, it's like the ultimate of like, just own it. And the drunk part is pushing the ego aside so it can just own the fact that it just wants to hook up. Where, and that to me is not that that's the beautiful thing, but the beautiful part of this is that the love versus fear is the love is, to me is love is saying, okay, I'm just going to own this. I'm going to own the fact that, like for me personally, I would say that I'm probably 10 pounds overweight as far as whatever the weight metric is.
Mm-hmm.
And I could sit here and say, well, you know, I don't want to work out because of this or that or blah, blah, blah. Well, the bottom line is A, I don't like working out. And two, I like foods that put extra weight on. I'm not morbidly obese, and I keep from being morbidly obese because I can't picture myself there. Now, the thing is I believe in my own belief that I'm 10 pounds overweight, but I'm 10 pounds overweight because I don't like to exercise and I like foods that put on 10 pounds extra weight. I'm owning that. You see what I'm saying? But the fear is a whole different matter. The fear is, I think, when people don't own what it is they love. And there's one excuse after another excuse because they can't face, which is weird. This is the ego, which is weird, is crazy making, is they can't face what it is that they love.
Kind of like with what you just said, where if you're sitting there going, oh man, I've never run a marathon. I would like to run a marathon. Oh, I'm 10 pounds overweight. I guess that's never going to happen because you have to be healthy to run in a marathon. And I'm 10 pounds overweight, which means I'm not healthy enough to run in a marathon. Is that kind of like what you're saying, where it's just like the ego gets in the way and puts in all these roadblocks and says, you know, you're not good enough to run in a marathon. Who do you think you're talking about?
Right.
And even if you were half a pound overweight, like, I'm half a pound overweight. I can't run in a marathon because I'm not my ideal healthy weight. And you have to be healthy enough to run in a marathon. And I don't exercise as much as I, and, you know, the whole ego can just go wild with, you know, all these ideas and reasons why you shouldn't. But then, you know, and I think that's the part where you may have been talking about earlier, where the love part overshadows the fear part, even for just a moment. And an action happens, it's the first step to living more out of love than out of fear.
Yeah. And here's what's interesting. It gets really even more convoluted, I think, Donald.
Okay.
Because, like, you're talking about the person who wants to run the marathon, but they're overweight, uh-huh. Right? And let's say that this person that you're talking about, she's sitting, and I don't know why I'm using a she now. I just decided, we'll switch up genders for fun. Okay. So
Nancy McMulderberry.
Yeah. Relation to Fred McMulderberry? Who knows?
Sister? Cousin? I don't know.
Well, was he married in that episode? We're going to have to find out because there was something about a wife.
He was married for one of our examples in there when he was working at the factory.
Okay. Well, I think they might have split up. We might have used that analogy, but I don't remember. We'll have to do some digging back in the episodes to find out.
Anyway,
but Nancy McMulderberry, she wants to run a marathon, right?
Okay.
She dreams of running a marathon, and her friend says, why don't you run a marathon? She says, because I'm not healthy and I'm overweight, and I work insane hours, and I just cannot find the time to get in shape. And then 2 weeks later, her friend's just like, again with this marathon thing. Why don't you just do it? Well, I can't. I wish I could someday, but I can't. Maybe Nancy, is it Nancy?
Yeah.
Nancy McMulderberry, maybe her love is the self-depreciation.
Oh.
Maybe the dream of the marathon is a perfect way for her to set up the fact that she's not good enough.
Or looking for compliments.
That's another thing. She could be looking for this constant validation.
Because if she's constantly saying, I would love to do a marathon, but I'm just not good enough, when she's talking with her friends or family, and her friends and family are saying, oh, no, you're totally can do it. You have, you know, kind of like a pep talk. And, like, that's all I needed was just a pep talk. I feel better now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. I'll give you a little a case.
Okay.
It's a scenario where Jackie had a business relationship, a personal business relationship with another person, and this person was overweight, and Jackie said, I think I'm going to sever this. She was seeing this woman for a service, and she said, I think I'm going to stop seeing this woman for a service because she's intensely negative, because all she does is talk about how things don't go right for her, how overweight she is, and she is so fixated on being really, really overweight when she was a bit overweight but not morbidly obese by any stretch of the imagination.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, but I like the service that she's providing, and I don't really – I like the service, but it seems like a high cost, and my energy feels so drained, and I don't know. And I can't find anyone else to provide the level of service that this person is doing. And I said, well, go there and just hold your own. Just don't let her take that, because she's needing that. She's needing, she's eating that up, and the, and she's kind of being vampiric. Is that the word?
Yeah, that works.
In a sense. So what she did was, is every time this person would say this self-depreciating thing, Jackie would say something positive. She'd say, well, I'm sorry to hear that, but on the upside, this and this. And she kept doing this over and over again, and this woman eventually just, it, she gave up. She stopped the self-depreciation because it was too exhausting to try to keep it up and not get that, that, you know, not suck the energy back,
mm-hmm.
you see. So, so in that case, there was something she was getting. She was getting, because Jackie also talked to other people who other clients of this woman, and she's, and they got the same thing. She says, I like going to her, but she's just so negative and it's just so draining.
Mm-hmm.
So Jackie didn't allow herself to be drained and kept the light up and the positivity. And it just went to show that there was a function for this woman doing it. It wasn't just a, well, she's in bad straits, but there was something she was just absorbing from doing this. So yeah, there was a love there. It's backwards and twisted, but it's a love.
Yeah, I remember years ago, I was hanging out with some friends that were very negative, and you know, not ambitious in the least whatsoever. And this is from my, obviously from my perception, of course. The reason why I stayed with them for years is because I know that I have a strong desire to be in, socialize with people, and they offered 3 to 4 nights a week where we could all socialize. Mm-hmm. And I loved it, and it was awesome. And then there was at one point where the negativity overwhelmed my desire to have socializing, and then I went back in my past. I'm just like, you know what, I always find friends. I know that I always find friends. If I'm spending all my time with these people, then I'll never find the people that are more positive. Well, I didn't say, I'm done with you guys, I'll see you later. We were all on a live journal, a blog site that is still around, believe it or not. And I just pretty much hid them from my feed, as it were. Using Facebook analogy, it's like I hid them from my news feed. Well, back then, live journal let the person know that you hid them.
Ah.
I did not know this. Mm. All of a sudden, it goes crazy, and people are like, why are you hiding me? La, la, la. Okay, fine. If you don't want to be a part of my life, then I don't want to be a part of your life. And blow, it's gone. And about 7 months later, I started finding new groups to hang out with. And life was so much better because the people I was hanging out with were so much more positive than the people that I had, you know, just left. And that has continued to this day, where it's just like, wow, if I knew that the friends that I would have met, that I would meet after the, those friends were so much more positive influence on me, I would have done it so much sooner. And it's one of those weird things where this was the first time that me socializing with people is an absolute necessity. It's like food, water, or drink. If I don't socialize on a regular basis with people, you know, I literally start getting very depressed and just goes downhill from there. Mm-hmm. So for me to actually say, okay, I'm removing these people from my life and they're my only source of socializing right now. That's like saying to a meth dealer, like, we're taking you off the meth.
Yeah.
Exactly. And there's nothing else that you're putting in place of it. So it was a huge lesson, but at the same time, it kind of goes back to what I was saying earlier, where things are going to change one way or another, and you can have things change on your own terms or not.
Well, and this might hint back to the power episode, but I think there are a lot of people who would prefer to have things change in spite of what they want, in quotes, because it provides them with something. It provides them with that feeling of being out of control of their lives, of the victimization, because then they can't fail. Well, if like Fred McMulderberry, if he goes out and he applies for the job and he gets shot down, well, if he hadn't applied for the job, if he hadn't made that choice on his own behalf, he wouldn't have got shot down. So that was his fault. But if there are no jobs out there, no matter what he does, and all the chips fall where they may, where it was outside of my control, so it wasn't my fault, so it's a relief to, for him. And I think that what you're talking about, the change without that, I think that's sometimes people, that is their love. Their love is to be the victim. Their love, they love to not have to take personal responsibility because it's so much harder to do so, and it's so much easier. Really, I do think there's a lot of people that, that the victim role is just easy to do.
And there's also an endorphin rush every so often.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's take somebody who is negative. We're not anyone in particular, just somebody. You know, they're always talking about, oh, my life is so hard. I have to do this again. Oh, this is so difficult. All of a sudden, they have one thing happen that is extremely positive and unexpected. Like, oh, my job that I was at 3 years ago found out that they didn't pay me, you know, $150, so they sent me a check, and now I have $150 more. All of a sudden, that produces a huge rush of endorphins just, you know, temporarily. It's like, I am lucky. I am lucky. And then all of a sudden it wears off, and they're able to be like, okay. And the contrast between being, you know, like, well, see, if I'm always being negative, if I'm always, you know, spitting on the world and letting the world know how terrible everything is for me, it'll occasionally give me something back. And when it gives that, then when it does give that something back, then I get this huge rush for just a moment of just extreme happiness. And even if it comes years, you know, in between those, it's enough to wait for it to come back again.
I know what you're saying. What you're saying, and correct me if I'm wrong, what you're saying is that from having to sit in a mode of negativity, when you get a positive experience, it is such a break, it's such a relief and a breath of fresh air from the negativity. You need that spans of negative run to create that space to have a relief from.
Yeah, kind of like we'll use Fred Mulderberry back at the bar again. Let's say, I know he was married before, but he got divorced and he hasn't had sex in, let's say, 3 years. By most people's accounts in the Western world, that's a long time. And so he's just like, I'm just not lucky with women because, you know, one woman threw me to the curb, so why would any other woman want me? And then all of a sudden, this one woman goes home and sleeps with him, and he's like, woohoo! And all of a sudden, kind of like what I think you were saying, is that one woohoo out of 3 years was just like, okay, yes, I can continue to be, you know, how did I get that person? Well, I was being down on myself. Oh, being down on myself works. So if I'm a negative person, then good things happen for me, if that makes sense. Or however we find out to work in the world, where it's like, oh, if I do this, then I get this. If I act this way, people respond to me this way.
Mm-hmm.
I think going back to the topic, it's kind of like if you spend your whole life figuring out how people respond to you with what you do and everything, and then you decide to change it, that's when the ego comes in and says, oh, well, if you change the way you express yourself this way, people probably won't respond to you the way that the way they have in the past that you've really come to enjoy. We don't know how they'll respond to you, and it might not be good. So don't change anything. Stay the same. Stay the course.
Yeah, and I think that ego steps in there because we're basing these where we need to be and where we should be on a criteria that's outside of ourselves that we've adopted rather than what's natural to ourselves. In fact, I would say that those people that let their ego create these fears that allow and ensure them to be in the place that they are, especially in the victim modes, the fear and the ego does a beautiful job of masking the fact that you are creating what you're creating. Because it doesn't work if you acknowledge that you're creating it. If you're in a victim place and you're saying, this is what the world has done to me, how does that work when if you're really the source of your own power and if you really create your own reality and are responsible for the outcome of your life, then that falls flat. You can't use a victim mentality and sell that very well if you really are creating your own reality. So the ego and the fears are doing that. They're a way of making twisting it back on itself so that you can have what you love and still be innocent of not really, let me see how I can put this. You can have what you love. And if you love this thing that you're not supposed to love because of what you've, what society says, but yet you love it anyway. Like, for example, if you love being homeless because you don't have to answer to anyone, because you don't have to pay a mortgage, because you're not responsible for anything except for you finding your next meal. What if all that is a love?
Mm-hmm.
But yet society says, and they maybe they don't care, but the society says, well, you need to work and be part of society and contribute. Well, the fear is just going to say, well, it's all these circumstances that have created this for me so that it's acceptable. It doesn't work if you say, well, I'm responsible for my own life. And you say, well, I thought society created it for you.
That's the illusion right there.
That's the illusion. Where I think there are people who are homeless, but they share joy and they travel the country and they do things for other people and they give everything they have. They're homeless, but they're not victims because they said, we've chosen this life. We've chosen this life and we feel enriched and rewarded and fulfilled. And we want to share the joy and the happiness we've found with other people. So they don't see, because they're not sitting there saying, society made me be happy.
Yeah.
Society made me find joy and I'm untethered because I have no possessions. But it's the other side where that's the fear, and that's where the fear creates this weird illusion of victimhood and helplessness.
Yeah, and there are people that are homeless in this country, and I'm sure in other countries that span the gambit of being homeless by choice and being homeless by circumstance and all this other stuff. So I just want to say, you know, we're not saying, well, homeless people can be happy too. I'm like, no. We're saying, yes, there are probably homeless people that are out there that are happy and there are out there that are not happy. But I'm actually kind of curious, because if we can have an illusion, if we can have this ego's illusion based out of fear, can we also have an ego's illusion based out of love?
Well, only to the degree that life is an illusion, but we're not going to do that. We can't really do that. I know what you're asking, and I'm not going to do that to you. I've done it in many other episodes. I'm going to give you a break.
So
your birthday's coming soon, so.
Yeah, I know. You're being nice to me for my birthday. Oh,
exactly.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And 20 years from now, someone will be listening to this like, Lince's birthday, they never said.
That's right.
So, but no, I'm actually kind of curious, because if we said that, you said that there's only varying degrees of love and that fear is just a low degree of love. Is that correct?
Well, I don't even think they're degrees. I think they're manifestations or they're byproducts of love.
Okay, so my whole thought is, you know, if you can actually have this illusion out of fear of how of your circumstances and, you know, the world treating you badly and everything, can the ego and love, can they both work on you, your conscious mind together?
I think once the ego gets into the realm of love, then it starts to manifest fear.
Oh.
That's what I think. I think when the ego gets involved, then you're going to start seeing fear start to pop up.
So kind of like they're like oil and water.
I think the ego is a way of justifying why you can't accept yourself.
Okay.
And that's what it does. The ego is saying, okay, these rules are out here in society that you're not matching. What are you going to do about it? And why is this the case?
So basically the ego is everybody throughout your whole life that has ever told you you're not good enough and this is why and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And love is everything that tells you you are good enough and this is why. Can we make that blanket statement?
We can to a degree, but it depends on whether or not you accept it. Because it doesn't matter how many people say that you're not good enough if you don't accept it.
Ah, but why would you want to accept it if it works for you, if there's a payoff for you, if it gives you a sense of being alive or something or comfort, or it's just what you know? And you don't want to attempt to learn a whole bunch of new rules and everything by moving into something other that you don't already know.
Well, I'm going to answer it this way. This is where fear comes up, because the ego is, this is why the fear is more of the illusion than love.
Okay.
Because if somebody says you're not good enough, right? And you accept that you're not good enough. And so what you do is you're doing everything in your power to validate your truth. Your truth is that you're not good enough. So you do all these things to validate that, because who your sense of identity as a person that has a low self-worth is very important. So if you have a low self-worth, why are you going through such a great effort to validate that? Why is that identity of a person who's not very valuable so important to you? Why do you work so hard to maintain that identity? It's because you believe in it. You've placed a high value on your low self-worth, which is an oxymoron, which is a contradiction. That's why the ego becomes an illusion, because once you start contradicting your own self-worth, you're saying, I'm worth the fact that I am not worth anything. then it doesn't make any sense anymore. And so that's why the ego is doing this. I mean, we all have self-value to one degree or another. And even the suicides, I would say, even the suicides have value of one degree or another. And they have such a great value of what it is, the self-identity needs to validate it constantly. Why would you validate something you had no value in?
But on the same token, what if whoever was in your life that was telling you that you're not good enough or you can't do that was there to push you to work harder to achieve as much of what they're saying you can't do, to allow you to have some kind of confidence in being challenged and coming out successful? Let's say you have a coach in middle school or high school who is saying, you are terrible at football. You are the worst person I've ever seen. So you work at it, you work at it. A couple of years go by, and you try out for the football team again. And he's like, you're not as bad as you were, but you're still not good enough to play on this team. And then, like, your senior year, you try out, and he's like, okay, fine, you're good enough. You're finally good enough to be on our team, and they get on the team. All those years of working towards something that somebody was constantly telling you you weren't good at, and then finally having it pay off where you got to be on, you reached your goal of being on a football team, even if it was just for 1 year, that's a huge confidence boost right there.
You're saying that it was a function for this person to, there was a function in you excelling based on this person's doubt in you, or as it were.
Yeah, and from what I'm hearing, from what you were saying, is kind of like, that's usually not a good thing. Is well, you didn't say it wasn't a good thing. You're basically saying, you know, why would you work so hard at something that people are constantly telling you that you're not good at, unless you had some reason to believe it and wanted to prove them wrong or prove yourself wrong ultimately?
Well, I don't even think it. Sometimes I think it's about proving people wrong, but I don't think it is ultimately. Because okay. If this coach takes John and Joe,
okay,
and he's saying this about football. John, he says, you're no good. Joe, he says, you're no good. John says, well, this coach thinks I'm no good, so I'm not going to do this. And he quits. Joe says, this coach thinks I'm no good. It doesn't keep me from loving to do this. I love doing this. I know I'm not very good at it, but I love doing it. And eventually, he continues to do it, and the love of it just keeps him excelling in spite of the odds, because he's identified with the love of it.
I see what you're saying, yeah.
And Joe, no, excuse me, John, the first one, identified with the love of validation from the coach. In other words, he was saying, you know, I love basing who I am on the feedback that I get from another person.
External validation.
External validation. And sometimes, and then the ego got built from that. The internal validation that Joe received, the ego didn't have anything to do with it. I mean, the ego might have, in this way, you show him right, but it was only a tool at that point.
Gotcha. Interesting. Very cool.
I know, right? I was thinking about this a while, about the whole love and fear thing, and I could not wrap myself around the fact that we only did something out of fear without any love behind it. because it always seemed to point back to love one way or another. It always did.
All signs point to love.
Yeah, all signs point to love. I really think that is the case. And I think that the bottom line of love in getting out of fear is just own it. That's all you have to do. And, you know, that's what I'm saying to do. Just own it.
Own your love?
Well, own what it is and you'll find the love in there. You really will.
Because that sounds like a pop song. Own your love.
Probably, yeah.
It probably is somewhere like, own your love.
I mean, an interesting thing is, as I was watching, there's a news article where a woman, I think she was in Oregon, and she, in our recent election here with President Obama being elected, during when the whole election was coming out, she had used the very derogatory racial term in reference to him, and she said, let's hope that he gets assassinated or something to that degree. I'm paraphrasing, but it was that degree. She did make the derogatory term, the N-word, as it said, and she did say something about him being assassinated. When they asked her about this, they interviewed her on the news because it got on Twitter, and she said, I don't see anything wrong with what I did or what I said. And then they said, are you a racist? And she said, no, I'm not a racist. Wow. And to me, I'm just like, you know, you are what you are. If you're a racist, you're a racist. But for her, it was disappointing on so many levels. But the thing I was just like is, why don't you just own the fact that you're a racist, that you do not approve of? If you're going to use derogatory racial terms, then how are you going to say you're not a racist? I would have had way more respect. I didn't have much respect for her, as it were. But I can accept that this is her path and her life experience, and I don't know what she's gone through to have come to this point. So I can't really pass any judgment on her. But at least own it. Just own your racism. If you're a racist, just own it. But there we go. She's operating in a very fear-based mode because she is in a place where she's not accepting her who she is. And it's created all this negativity and victimization and all these other things that I would assume goes with that perspective.
Yeah, yeah. And I, when you put it that way, where all signs point to love in varying degrees, then I can see how there is no middle line between fear and love. Like I was mentioning earlier, it's like, where's the absolute zero point between switching from fear to love? Because like you'd mentioned, it's like, it's all love. There is no line if it's all love.
Right, exactly.
If it's all the ocean, you can't say, okay, this wave right here is the dividing line between this ocean and that ocean. Well, the wave moved. Oh, darn. Okay, now, okay, this wave right... Oh, man.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the ocean is a really good analogy for that. Even go back to your state analogy. You said when you're standing on the line between two states, well, that was a line that was created by government bodies and whatnot. I mean, except for if you're using a river for a line, and then even there, where's the dividing line between the two states? Is the river the no man's land, or is there a line that you could draw right in the middle of the river? It's a line that we've created.
Yeah.
It's not really there.
Oh. So is that kind of like your final thoughts on the whole fear and love, or do you have something else that you'd like to add? Because I really don't have anything else to add to that.
Yeah, those are my final thoughts. I would end up just pulling something out that I just said before and saying it again. So,
I would do the same thing. I would do the same thing. But I've never looked at it the way that you present it, where everything is love and there is no fear. It's all just varying degrees of love. I'm like, oh, well, that's kind of different. That's kind of new. That's, for me, that's kind of like, that has just enormous implications for people and things and everything. And then when I look at it the other way, it's like, and yet nothing changes because it's just a different way of looking at it.
Right, exactly. It's just a degree of distortion, I think. How far away you are from it, you know. So you did ask about the distortion part of it. And yeah, there's definitely distortion there.
So if I was Fred McMoldenberry in the bar with beer goggles, basically, it's like you took one of one of the lenses out, and so I have one eye that's distorted and one eye that's not.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's like, oh, this is kind of a freaky ride, man.
I think he's going to get sick in that bar. Oh, if he's got that kind of distortion level going, his room's spinning. He's getting sick, and you know what? He's taking nobody home.
Well, we'll have to wait for further episodes to see what happens in the life and times of Fred McMulderberry.
Tune in a future episode. Will Fred and Nancy get back together?
And I don't know. I don't think Nancy was his wife's name. I think it was Gloria or something. But Nancy just seemed to work right for me.
Yeah, well, you know, it could have been his second wife.
Oh,
you never know. Right. You know, he may have been married multiple times. And he probably, you know, this trend might continue if he doesn't get his act together.
Fred McMulderberry's a player.
He is a player.
He doesn't like to go for job interviews.
Yeah.
He just likes jobs to be handed to him.
He does. And maybe he's looking for the right woman to just hand him a job. I don't know.
Oh, wait. Maybe that's his job. He's a gigolo.
Maybe.
He's
maybe,
so
but
good.
Not a very good one, if this is the case.
Well, no, he just started his new job as a gigolo.
Yeah, I don't know how you
he's
go
getting his
on
training
on a widget, making widgets to gigolo, because he made widgets in another episode, and now he's a gigolo. I don't know how that segue works on a resume. So I see you were making widgets, and then you became a gigolo. How did you make that career jump? How did you make jump vertical markets like that? So with that statement, I think we're going to wrap this guy.
Oh, good call. Good call. Good call. Well, David and I would like to take this opportunity to thank you for listening to this episode. If this is your first episode that you've heard from us, we hope you've enjoyed it. If you're a longtime listener, we thank you so much for continuing to join us on this little journey that David and I have started.
And here's where you can find us to continue this whole little journey that we're on. You can find our first and best is our website, which is taketheredpillpodcast.com. All the episodes there. We've got show notes to the things that we've talked about in the episodes, links to various websites. You can also find us on Facebook, TTRP Podcast. We're right there on Facebook. Be like our page, add comments, and see. We post our episodes there and some other kind of links here and there as well. And we also have a Twitter feed. And that is also TTRP Podcast, where we get links and all sorts of other fun stuff.
So for Take the Red Pill, my name is Donald Dalton, letting you know that it's all love.
And I am David Deere. Love it and just own it.